Good morning, everybody. Mr. President, ministers, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends and colleagues. It is indeed a great pleasure to welcome the President of Rwanda, His Excellency Paul Kagame, to the International Peace Institute's African Leaders Series. IPI started the African Leaders Series 2 years ago. The idea behind it is to offer a forum for African statesmen and women to engage with the UN community on key challenges facing the continent today. President Kagame is our third annual speaker, preceded by African Union Chairperson Jean Ping last year and President Wad of Senegal in 2007. Rwanda is a country of special importance to the international community. We are, of course, all profoundly aware of the tragic genocide which was perpetrated on much of the population in 1994. We are also aware that the international community failed to respond until it was too late. Indeed, the inability of the United Nations to act in time remains a blot on us all. 15 years after that terrible genocide, which killed at least 800,000 people, Rwanda is and remains at peace. This is indeed a great accomplishment, for which the President and his colleagues deserve much credit. But we also recognize the many challenges that remains, and that preventing the recurrence of such crimes against humanity in one single country is not enough. The tragedy of Rwanda is not only etched in our memory. It has led to major efforts by the United Nations to see that genocide and crimes against humanity, that it does not recur either in Africa or anywhere else. This is the underlying idea of the responsibility to protect, R2P, adopted by all member states in the 2005 World Summit. We applaud Rwanda's leadership in seeking to implement this concept in Africa. In this connection, I want to thank you, Mr. President, for inviting IPI to co-host, in partnership with Rwanda and Denmark, a workshop on the African peace and security architecture, operationalizing the African standby force in Kigali this past May. The workshop brought together senior African and UN officials for 2.5 days of in-depth consultations on steps needed to bring the African standby force to full realization. Your gracious hospitality was deeply appreciated. Rwanda also provides an encouraging example of post-conflict reconstruction and peace building. In the past decade, significant economic development has taken place. Infrastructure development projects have rebuilt much of the capital, Kigali, and other cities. The road system has been greatly improved, and large-scale electrification projects are underway. These are very positive developments that should be sustained. Rwanda's government has paid special attention to improving the status of women, assuring access to education for both girls and boys. Actually, over 50% of the Rwandan parliament are women. This is a record ahead of many other countries, also in the West, as well as in many other African nations. Rwanda is playing an important role in Africa's efforts to deal with the current economic and financial crisis, in particular to mitigate its impact on Africa's continuing economic growth and social and economic development. And, Mr. President, I think we all look forward to your comments on this important topic. Finally, I want to highlight Rwanda's actual and potential contribution to regional peacekeeping. We encourage the recent understandings between you and President Kabila of the Democratic Republic of the Congo to end the fighting in northeastern DRC. The region around you continues to be beset by conflicts, including in the Sudan and Somalia. Rwanda has an important role to play in the African Union's effort to resolve these conflicts, all of which have serious cross-border consequences. With this introduction, it is a great pleasure to give the floor to President Kagame for his remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Taji Rhodlasen, President of the International Peace Institute, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I thank the International Peace Institute for the opportunity to share with this esteemed audience how we, in Africa and in our region in particular, are pushing the boundaries of peace, reconciliation, and development. I'm pleased to state that on matters of stability, peace, and development, today's Africa is unrecognizable from that of yesteryear. Like other parts of the world, present-day preoccupation in Africa revolves around creating prosperity, especially strategies to mitigate the ongoing global economic crisis, including strengthening markets, regional integration, productivity, competitiveness, science, technology, and innovation. Greater peace and security are part of the recent achievements that are enabling most African countries to sustain economic growth rates of above 5%. This has been the case in the last half a decade or so before the current global economic crisis. This turnaround in Africa is illustrated by, among other things, emerging economic markets that are attracting bigger volumes of venture and equity capital in the context of improved capacity to trade and attract a larger share of foreign direct investment. Africa's sources of trade investment, in the meantime, have been broadening beyond our traditional partners of North America and Western Europe. Asian countries, especially China and India, have become key actors. More importantly, Africa's own private sector has been gaining strength in most sectors, notably in the mobile telecommunications, where several African companies have become highly profitable transnational operators. Mobile telephone technologies are also changing the lives of millions of Africans by increasing access to information, facilitating education, health, and trade, reaching even the remotest villages. A good indication of our continent's recent developmental milestone is the various reforms aimed at improving business climate. The latest World Bank Group's Doing Business report shows that sub-Saharan Africa is reforming at a fast pace. For example, Liberia, a recent graduate from conflict, has become the second most active reformer in sub-Saharan Africa, while another post-conflict state, Sierra Leone, is making good progress in that direction. Our country, Rwanda, has been identified as the top reformer worldwide, moving from 143rd position to 67th out of 183 countries. Yes, our continent still has a long way to go in recovering from decades of endemic conflict. There were times from the 1970s to the early 1990s when there was neither peace to keep nor regional or continental institutions to keep the peace. With the exception of a few conflict hotspots, Africa is a different place today. The establishment of the African Union with a fundamentally different vision and mindset from its predecessor, the Organization of African Unity, is indicative of this significant shift. This is particularly the case in peace support operations, as demonstrated, for example, by the African Union's Peace and Security Council that plays an active role in promoting and keeping peace. It is through this institutional framework that the African Union deployed a mission in Burundi in 2003 to monitor the ceasefire agreement, and in particular Sudan in 2004, before the mission became a joint effort with the United Nations in the year 2007. Rwanda has participated actively in peacekeeping operations of the African and UN-led peace missions. This includes the UN African Union mission in Darfur, where we remain the largest contributor. Let me now turn to our own neighborhood, where, together with our colleagues in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have recently achieved what I may describe as a major breakthrough towards extending the boundaries of peace. Although this particular conflict has roots in the colonial and post-colonial history of our region, the current situation arose in mid-1994 when the government that committed genocide in our country fled with all its institutions and a hostage population of 3 million Rwandans into what was then Zaire. Regrettably, the definition of this problem kept changing in the minds of many in the international community, resulting in delaying the closure of this chapter of misery and havoc. Initially, the issue was caring for the millions of refugees in camps in eastern Zaire. Considerable resources were expended into this effort. There was, however, no corresponding willingness to separate genuine refugees from the genocidal forces that were openly armed and rearming in the camps. At the time, Rwanda had no option when the international community did not intervene to repatriate our citizens and seek justice and accountability from those who perpetrated the genocide. We had to deal with this because we understood what would happen in the future. Our intervention brought about another distorted definition of the problem. Rwanda was now accused of exploiting DRC's natural resources using the pretext of hunting genocide perpetrators. Numerous reports on this subject were written by the experts. All of them were false and were not worthy of the resources and time spent on them. I'm always amazed, quite frankly, by the naivety of this discourse. You just do not go and gather minerals on the ground or from underground and instantly become rich. The question I always ask is this: if Rwanda does not have the technical capacity to exploit our own mineral resources, how can we take advantage of those in DRC? A country like many others in Africa that have not fully utilized these resources for decades, for their own advancement. These issues are far more complex and lead to entirely different questions. In reality, these accusations have always been a diversion from the truth. No one should be under the illusion that Rwanda's modest developmental achievements since 1994 are based on such illegal exploitation of the resources of another country. We are steadily improving the lives of our people because Rwanda is making all the effort to build a nation of laws and institutions that promote security, peace, reconciliation, and development. We are painstakingly building the confidence of domestic and foreign investors to put their money into our hotels, energy projects, agriculture, the construction industry, and ICT on the basis of transparent governance and predictability. We wish to work with successful nations and build productive capacities to fit into the global competition, not anything less. These objectives can only become further enhanced by a stable, peaceful, and a more integrated sub-region, as opposed to one where criminal gangs with genocide ideologies roam our neighborhoods, pillaging and destroying communities, and killing or raping women and children. In the year 2002, the United Nations asked Rwanda to withdraw its forces from the DRC and said that they would assume the responsibility of disarming and dealing with the negative forces. We knew it was not going to be done, and it was not. The United Nations set up MONUC, a peacekeeping mission of 17,000 soldiers that have been in the DRC for 7 years at a very high cost without corresponding results. The genocidal forces continued to operate, destabilizing both the host country, DRC, and Rwanda. This situation has now changed fundamentally because Rwanda and DRC both recognize that we must work together to find answers to this, our problem. When Rwanda and the DRC undertook a joint military operation against the negative forces earlier this year, some skeptics once again expressed the fear that things were going to get worse and that there was going to be a humanitarian catastrophe. This could not have been further from the truth. The results were there to speak for themselves. In the brief period of the joint operations, we seriously weakened the command and control structure of these negative forces. Nearly 1,000 combatants and over 5,000 civilians were repatriated to Rwanda. Most significantly, confidence at leadership and citizen levels at the successful Congolese and Rwandan collaboration has drastically increased. Following the achievements of the joint operations with our counterparts in the DRC, MONUC has also joined the Congolese armed forces to continue or supported and to continue the fight against the destructive forces in eastern DRC. On the political and the diplomatic front, we have now exchanged ambassadors with the DRC, paving the way for further efforts in the more important realms of economic growth and development, including joint projects in energy, environment, trade, and investment. We realize that there is still a lot of work to be done. and we can continue to count on the international community, but this time around with a serious focus on dealing with the root causes of the problem in the sub-region. There is no doubt that things can change for the better in this regard if we continue with the right approach. We appreciate many global leaders, including the United Nations Secretary General, that have been highly supportive of these efforts. Let me conclude by restating that today's Africa is increasingly one that seeks its own solutions as well as different relationships with the international community, one based on mutual respect, trust, and a collaborative outlook. We acknowledge that our continent still faces considerable developmental challenges compounded by the ongoing global economic crisis, but our national, regional, and continental institutions are working diligently to find appropriate and responsible solutions for greater peace and security. Our sub-region and the African continent should remain focused on the bigger objective of socio-economic transformation while paying attention to strategic and corrective measures required to preempt factors that undermine this vision and agenda. I'm most certain that we will continue to make progress in our quest for pushing the boundaries of peace, reconciliation, and development on our continent. I thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, for a terrific and very illuminating presentation. And I think I speak for all when I say that I found it intriguing and to the point. I will now open the floor for comments and questions.
John Hirsch from the International Peace Institute. First, thank you very much for your remarks, Mr. President. You referred to justice and accountability in your speech. I wonder if you could share with us what you think are the important forums. There's obviously been the tribunal in Arusha. You've had your own tribunals in Rwanda. There's now the International Criminal Court, which has been trying to prosecute various people. Some of these have been put forward by African countries, Ituri and so on. And then we have the proposed indictment of President Bashir of Sudan. I wonder if you could comment on your own perception of justice and accountability in Africa.
I think justice and accountability are important. They are even more important in places like in our own case and in many other cases where we've seen a need for that. But you can treat it at a national level and then you can treat it universally, internationally. At the national level, like in our case, there has been need for justice and accountability. At the same time, this has been blended or toned down, if you will, by the desire to have reconciliation as well. So in our particular case, pursuing justice and at the same time pursuing reconciliation takes a different form. Normally these are processes that would affect one another or they would go counter to one another, but at the same time they have got to be carried out. So we want justice and accountability, we also want reconciliation, and has been involving giving amnesty or categorizing responsibilities and trying to ignore some of the things, and you move on. So there is a lot of balancing act to be done, like in our case, on issues of justice and accountability, and then because of the need of reconciliation, we undergo so many processes, including some of the innovations you have had to apply relating to our traditions and cultures of the past and the Gacaca courts to try and really achieve justice and accountability, but at the same time reconcile the society that has been so deeply affected by this, and then have a stable situation. Now, at the international level, where you have these issues coming up, like international criminal court, my take on this is that if we are talking about international justice or issues of international criminal court and so on and so forth, we must do those things that don't make this process as if it is targeted or it is targeting one category of people in this world we live in. So we have to avoid ICC being seen as if it's about pursuing the Africans or developing countries or the weak countries, but rather justice that is seen to be dispensed globally, internationally. And I think this is where the problem comes in. And there have been lots of arguments about this back and forth. On one hand, even with some contradictions. I remember in some arguments, people have said, well, International Criminal Court, after all, responds to governments, you know, requests to indict this and that. And then, like in the case of Sudan, of course, I'm not sure it is the government that requested the indictment of Bashir. So it must have come from somewhere else. And for me, the argument here hasn't been so much about is the president of Sudan responsible for this or that or not responsible for that, as it is to put into question this whole process and how it is going to work. Whether it is going to be silent in some cases or pursue other cases, how equitable is it? How is it approaching justice to make sure that people internationally, all of us, are comfortable that it is really carrying out justice on equal basis, where developed countries may be responsible for some of the problems I even mentioned in my speech? There is silence about that. I will not hide the fact that genocide in Rwanda, the causes of it, are not Rwandan, are not African. Yes, the root causes of genocide in Rwanda, the killing of the million people we lost, has its roots somewhere else. Even during the time of genocide, the people who got involved, who supervised, who participated in the killing, most of these people were outside our borders, from outside our borders, from outside our continent. Why does it reach there and become silent? Why don't some of these people ever be seen to be asked to account for these responsibilities? So, are we having international justice fairly dispensed, even through the ICC? I don't know. That's debatable. My views are that there is a lot to talk about and probably to review, but my consistency is about can we, if it is justice, let it be justice and justice for all. It can't be justice for one group of people and not for the other. Yet we live in the same world that affect each other the way it has happened. That's my take on this question.
Hello, my name is Deborah Scratz and I'm a filmmaker. Good morning, Mr. President. I wondered if you might speak a little bit about the reintegration program that's going on in Rwanda that's been incredibly successful and I think hasn't gotten enough press attention.
Yes, we've in the last 15 years in Rwanda, as it relates to the first question, we have been trying to pursue justice and accountability, but more importantly, reconciliation, which brings about reintegration, making sure that people settle down and we rebuild the country on the basis of taking our country back to being one nation, even if it has a lot of diversity in it. We want to say we can use diversity for the benefit of the country, for the common good of everyone, not to break apart the country as it has, as we have seen in the past. So we most of these people have been coming back from Eastern Congo, from elsewhere, who were in the refugee camps or who were responsible for the genocide or who have been outside. The 3 million I mentioned in my speech have been fully reintegrated in the country and the citizens that are benefiting from the progress the country is making and are actually part of the progress the country is making. And we have institutions and processes that carry out this reintegration to the point that whether it is the former combatants who come back or the civilians who have been coming back, we process them effectively to reintegrate back in our society, and it has been working for the last between 10 and 15 years or so, and has been very successful.
Edith Lederer from the Associated Press. Mr. President, I wonder if you could elaborate on how you see peace finally being restored along the border of Rwanda and into eastern Congo. And at the beginning, Mr. Larson said that Rwanda had a role to play in both Somalia and Sudan in trying to help bring peace to those troubled nations. And I wonder if you could tell us what you see as that role.
I think I can say we've made very good progress. The problem is not fully resolved. And I'm saying this because it depends on a number of things. I can't stand here and say because of collaboration between DRC and Rwanda, all problems have been resolved. The major problems have been resolved. That's the starting point. The other problems will continue to be resolved depending on national institutions that deal with that, whether DRC or Rwanda. There are things we've got to do within our borders that may not entirely depend on each other. In DRC, they have their own setup, they have their own responsibilities to their own country. How effectively they are able to manage these complex problems they have to deal with may be different from how we manage to deal with our own problems within our borders. But these collaborative efforts are very important, and they are the ones I was referring to that have made a huge difference, as we still each remain with issues to deal with in our own countries. So good progress in DRC in terms of building institutions, in terms of how they manage their own affairs and so on and so forth will be helpful to them and will in the end also be helpful to ourselves, and how well we manage those will also be helpful to the common interests we can work on. In Sudan, we have a contingent that is deployed under the AU and the UN, as I said earlier, operating in Darfur. And we have another force associated with the problem of Khartoum and southern Sudan that has been going on as well. In Somalia, we haven't deployed our troops there, but what we have been doing has been to train some of their forces. That was our contribution, because we could not have forces deployed in two different areas to the levels that were required. Like in Sudan, we have 3,000, close to 500 troops. We couldn't deploy the same number in Somalia, and yet we could also not deploy a small force in a situation like that of Somalia. If you deploy there, then you want to take there a sizable force that will protect itself, but you also do what is required. So we could not do both to those levels. What we opted for was to make our contribution in terms of helping train the Somali forces, the army, or the police, as that will be needed in the near future.
Thank you very much, President Kagame. My name is Anusura Tiperu from Uganda. I just wanted to appreciate the fact that you have clearly come up and explained Rwanda's role in DRC, because oftentimes some of the East African countries are looked at as antagonists rather than those seeking to find out how to get overall stability in their region. And I'm glad in particular for the fact that you have struck a relationship with President Kabila, because as a person coming from East Africa, we know that if Congo is not stable, then all the five countries in East Africa will never be stable. So on that note, I just don't want to ask a question, but to appreciate you as chairman of Summit for the East African Community for the effort that you've done in working with your colleagues to ensure overall stability in East African region. Asante ni sana.
Thank you, Asante.
Eddie Mandrick with the Global Kids. It's a tremendous honor to be here, Mr. President, to have you here, sorry. My question is about the issue of dead aid. Dambisa Moyo has a book called Dead Aid, and in it she's sharply critical of the development agenda that's based on aid dependency. What is your opinion? Is aid dead, and what are the most viable alternatives?
Dead aid... Well, I'm not responsible for these terms, either dead aid or live aid. It's not my... But my country is a recipient, or has been a recipient of aid. At the same time, I have views about aid. Aid has been useful and can be useful, but aid can also be a problem. These are my views. Aid can be useful, and in some cases has been useful, especially if it does, or it helps people, or it does those things that eventually will help win people off aid. Because I don't see aid as something that should be there indefinitely. I see aid as something that helps people's efforts, helps people build foundations on which they can be able to continue building themselves, and helps build capacities of people to be able to depend on themselves. This is my definition of aid, and I think that's the whole essence of aid as we know it in all its history. In fact, some of the countries of the day we know that are developed benefited from this principle of aid long ago, about 60 years ago. But they are no longer need aid, now they are the ones giving aid. So, but the principle of aid applied then as it applies now. Aid can be a problem because it can also, and has in many cases, encouraged or created dependency. We have seen that. We live that life ourselves. We have seen people who don't do much or don't apply a lot of effort in trying to make their own the difference in their own lives, because they know somehow people will show up and help. So the moment you have that mentality of always waiting for people to show up and help, and you do not stand up and do quite some of the things you can do, then that is a problem, in my view. So my position is that we need to help our people, the Africans, the Rwandese, to build these capacities, to be able to confront the problems we face head-on, and do that as we benefit from support, but towards a situation where we do not have to depend on others in order to live. Because sometimes when you depend on others, even in the case of aid, aid does not come for free, even if at times it may appear so. The one who feeds you, the one you depend on, the one every day who hands out to you, will always dictate to you what you do and what you don't do. And that is deprivation of people's integrity and dignity, and we do not deserve that, we Rwandese or we Africans. This is my take on this. And there is no ambiguity about that. And we've seen that there are other things that can help Africa to develop, building on aid or over and above aid. That is about investment. That's about trade. In fact, we've discovered that if the developed world could treat us as they treat each other when it comes to trade, we probably eventually would not need aid, because what would come out of that is about 5 times larger than what comes in aid. But even in addition to that, this would come from our efforts. So it's something that gives us some dignity. It is something that would build on our self-belief, because we need that as well. But I think this dead aid, live aid, and who supports this, who supports the other one, I think in a sense becomes diversionary. We should be talking about effectiveness of whatever we are doing in changing people's lives. Are we discussing how aid would work effectively? If that is the debate, it's the debate I would like to see and participate in. Effectively, how effective is it? And effectively means graduating people of aid, not to make them perpetually dependent on aid. Yes.
Georgette Gagnon, Human Rights Watch. Mr. President, could you tell us what your position is on the closing of the Gacaca courts? We understand there's been some unclarity about whether they're going to close at the end of the year, and there is concern that among NGOs and others monitoring on the ground there that the courts are being used for other purposes. So could you just clarify the government's position on this? Thank you.
First of all, some of our problems, the problems we have is people depending on rumors about us and not seeing facts about things that happen in broad daylight or the kind of misinterpretations that take place. Well, first of all, Gacaca courts. The beginning and the end of Gacaca courts are things we have put in place ourselves. Now, you know, and I'm saying this because this issue of Gacaca and the person who asked this issue about Gacaca was questioned right from the start when it was being created. People said, no, this does not meet the international standards and so on and so forth. The people of Human Rights Watch asked these issues, and you said, oh, fine. You know, you may have a point, but tell us the alternative for us. And they had no alternative. And then you had to ask them and say, so, honorable members of Human Rights Watch, can you let us now continue with it? Because you have no alternative. They did not say yes or no. Anyway, we continued with the Gacaca process. In the process, they would always say, no, but the international standards. And they say, well, tell us what works to deal with our problem and to meet the international standards. No alternative. Now, there is a debate about closing it. So give us our time. We will close it when you have to close it. And so far, what I would say, we are happy with what it has given us, that nothing else could have given us, that because you didn't even give us anything else. So Gacaca is our own. The problems we have, we've taken them and we've made them our own, and we are looking for our own solutions. So I don't think really I have to be here interrogated about when we are closing, when we are doing this. We will close it when we feel it is time to close it. And we own the process. It serves us. It deals with our problems. And there's nothing we are doing just to please others. We are doing these things to solve our problems. So that is the way I would answer this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, first for spending so generously time with us here today. I know you have an extremely hectic schedule here in New York. And also, thank you for sharing with us your views on the situation in your country, in the sub-region, and on the continent, but also to share with us the way forward as you see it. And last but not at least, thank you for your leadership. I wish you good luck in the future for yourself, your country, and your people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.